Today is the day soccer fans across the globe have been waiting for.
Ladies and gentlemen, señoras y señores, mesdames et messieurs.
The draw for the 2026 World Cup. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we hear who's matching up. Also today in the UK, a backlog of untried court cases is prompting controversial suggestions for judicial reform. Some say what the country really needs is more lawyers and judges.
That's what the government needs to focus on before there's a wholesale attack on our constitutional rights.
We'll hear why some nations want to go back to using landmines in war. Plus, a new discovery reveals something used to make music in prehistoric times.
It is a way of giving sound to the past.
And self-driving deliveries in China. That's today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here this Friday. While self-driving cars are grabbing headlines here in the U.S., other uses of autonomous driving technology are revolutionizing daily life in China. Think street-sweeping robots and delivery drones, but also surveillance drones. The race to develop those innovations is full steam ahead. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel recently attended an auto show in Shenzhen, China. Here he is with the final installment from China.
As I walk into the Automotive World China exhibition, I am immediately drawn to a car. It's a Chinese-made electric SUV called the iCar. I hop in and ask through my interpreter how much it costs.
19,000. That's not bad.
Yeah.
It's billed as an affordable, rugged, retro-style car. On the outside, it looks kind of like a Land Rover from the 1960s, with big circular headlights and glitzy chrome detailing. On the inside, it feels like a futuristic spaceship equipped with buttery, highly cushioned, heated seats that feel like a warm glove.
It feels pretty good. It's comfortable. I want to test out the horn, but I'm not going to.
I quickly realize the iCar sales rep sitting inside with me thinks I'm on the hunt for a new ride. She starts telling me, with the help of my interpreter, about how this car can't be beat.
So iCar is like a brand for raw car. Yeah. It's like extreme powerful, extreme raw, yeah. Extreme
fun.
I think US people would
yeah,
love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
I think people from the US would love it, she tells me. The iCar is impressive, as are the other EVs on display here. But as I move through the convention center, I start to realize that the real cutting-edge technology being developed in China is found in smaller, more unassuming vehicles. This is the voice of Yan Ming with the self-driving tech company Rhino AI. He's telling me about their R5 autonomous vehicle, a driverless cargo van that's just received one of the exhibition's top awards. It's basically a simple white square with four wheels. The inside is like one big trunk, notably absent a steering wheel and driver's seat. Instead, on top, there's a series of little cameras, radars, and a 3D light sensor that helps the van sense cars and pedestrians that might be nearby. I'm curious how close the technology is to being ready for the real world.
Can these drive on regular streets where cars are driving?
Yes. Right here.
Ming sounds surprised when I ask this question and begins to tell me that they're not only capable of driving on city streets, they already are, including here in Shenzhen. The company has partnered with supermarkets, factories, and delivery companies in more than 150 Chinese cities, shipping food and parcels all around, no driver needed. I ask him what products like this could mean for the tens of thousands of delivery workers driving around cities like Shenzhen every day. Ming says these autonomous vans won't replace delivery drivers, but will make their jobs easier, handling longer routes from supermarkets and shipping centers, while drivers themselves will still do the shorter deliveries. Labor advocates, however, warn that self-driving technology has the capacity to destroy whole sectors of jobs. Nearby, I spot another little vehicle that looks nothing like a traditional car or truck. Just like the Rhino cargo van, it's basically a box on wheels. But this one is flashier, with more colors and doodads. Peng Wenming with the company Auto City tells me this is a fully autonomous sanitation device, a fancy way of describing a street cleaning robot. Painted with bright stripes of blue, green, and yellow with fuzzy little orange brushes on the bottom, it scoots along roads and sidewalks to clean the ground below. These sanitation robots, just like the self-driving delivery vans, Wenming says, are already on the ground in Shenzhen and dozens of other Chinese cities. Local officials are welcoming to these experimental technologies. And according to Stanley Ng, that's why in China, innovation is part of everyday life.
Local governments are very aggressive to promote new technology to serve the public here.
Ng is president of the Asia-Pacific Connected Vehicles Association, a government-supported group that works to promote self-driving technology in cities across Asia. He says the quieter, behind-the-scenes industries are where self-driving technology will make the biggest inroads in the coming years, because that's where municipalities and businesses can see huge savings. And even though robo-taxi pilot programs have launched in cities across China, the U.S., and the Middle East, he doesn't think that technology will be widely adopted on a personal level anytime soon, that he and I will keep driving our own cars.
Believe me, you and me will keep our car for coming 20 years.
Interesting.
The reason is we want to drive a car by ourselves, enjoy the driving.
We enjoy driving ourselves, Ng argues, but don't mind letting robots do the heavy lifting when it comes to deliveries, logistics, sanitation. And in those fields, China, with companies like Rhino and Auto City at the forefront, is paving a new, more efficient path. In the evening, after I head out from the auto show, I pause for some fresh air in a city park. A young girl is with her mom, learning to ride a bike with no training wheels. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot one of those brightly colored, self-driving sanitation robots I'd seen earlier at the convention. It's cleaning the park pavement and headed right toward the little girl and her bike. I almost shout something out, but before I do, the robot stops, turns, and starts cleaning in the other direction. The little girl is unfazed, probably used to seeing these things everywhere, and starts pedaling for the first time. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
In England and Wales, more than 78,000 criminal cases are waiting for their day in court. That backlog is expected to continue to grow if left unchecked. That's why Justice Secretary David Lammy has announced changes to the UK justice system. One change that has been proposed is for many court cases to forego the use of juries and instead be ruled on by a single judge or tribunal. Earlier today, I spoke with Shailesh Mehta. He's a barrister in London. Shailesh, under these new guidelines, which cases are going to get a jury trial and which will go before just a single judge?
Well, there's no clarity yet, but if one is to follow the document that the Justice Secretary has produced, then the vast majority will be tried either by a judge alone or a different tribunal without a jury. The only trials that will remain with a jury appear to be sex allegations of the most serious nature, murder and manslaughter, and other cases that are of public interest. And we don't quite know exactly what those are.
So 78,000 cases awaiting trial. That sounds like a lot. Has this problem grown in recent years in the UK?
It has. It's a horrifically big number, 7,000 to 8,000. And as you said earlier, it's a number that will grow. And that's a number just for the Crown Court. So these are trials that are for the jury. But your listeners should be aware that in the magistrates' court, in the lower court, where there is no jury, there's a backlog of 360,000 cases. So the problem is across the board for jury as well as non-jury trials in this country.
So do you see doing away with juries as an effective solution to speeding up this process?
I'm afraid I don't. I'm in the vast majority of barristers who are against this proposal for a number of reasons.
And barrister means same as lawyer here in the States?
Yes, there are two types of lawyers in the UK. There are solicitors and there are barristers. So I think the state's equivalent of a barrister would be a trial advocate or a trial attorney.
Thank you for that. David Lammy, the Justice Minister, says that he expects these changes to speed up this process by 20%. And you have yourself said this is a bad thing, that cases take so long to get to trial. So why do you think this is a poor solution?
Firstly, the suggestion that it'll speed up cases by 20%. There is absolutely no evidence that we can rely on for this at all. There's no evidence that this has been costed properly. There have been no trials. There's been no consultation. Of course, every lawyer in the UK is keen that there should be no backlog. What we're against is, firstly, a wholesale dismantling of what has come to be known as a constitutional right to a trial by jury without any proper evidence. And in fact, there are far better ways, we say, to achieve the efficiencies that the Justice Secretary rightly wants. For example, you go to any average Crown Court in England, Wales, this morning, and you'll discover that somewhere between 10% of courts and 30% of courts are lying dormant with no one in them. These are courts that used to have judge and jury trials. What the government needs to do is to appoint more judges. Because of the cutbacks in the payment of lawyers, there have been fewer and fewer criminal barristers in practice. And so often it's very difficult to find barristers of the right experience to defend or prosecute in trials. That's what the government needs to focus on to make sure that the inefficiencies at the moment, such as vacant courtrooms, those efficiencies are tackled before there's a wholesale attack on our constitutional rights.
The changes being proposed also do include increasing investment in the courts by more than $500 million per year.
Yes.
So that sounds significant.
Yes. Absolutely. And what we're saying is, yes, that investment should have been made many years ago. If that investment had been made in courts, in judges, in improving the pay of barristers, then we would not have had the backlog that we have. So we would welcome that investment. And in fact, that money can be used even now in appointing judges and using the courtrooms that lie empty. All of that is good justification for attacking the backlog, not good justification for attacking the right to a trial by jury.
Is this change a done deal?
I don't think so. Certainly, a number of commentators feel that the Justice Secretary has on purpose put out these so-called views of his. And this is a tried and tested political ploy, that you say X is going to happen, and then when you later on say, well, I've reflected on the profession's response, and in fact, only half of X is going to take place. And everyone thinks, oh, what a great person, he's listened, etc. And so this may well be a political ploy.
I want to end with this statistic that I was reading this morning in BBC reporting on this, which is in the UK, 6 out of 10 victims of rape are said to be withdrawing from prosecutions because of delays. And that, I think, just underlines the importance of speeding up these trials.
Yes, it's outrageous that the victims of crime in the most serious cases are withdrawing their complaint, if this research is right, because of the delays. And that is a societal problem that should have been addressed and needs to be addressed immediately. There is no evidence that these proposals will actually reduce the delay significantly at all.
That's Sailesh Mehta, a barrister based in London. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Germany's parliament today approved a controversial new military service law. Its goal is to boost the country's army by some 80,000 soldiers. This is in response to the perceived threat from Russia. Germany's foreign minister has accused the country of, quote, creating the option of a war against NATO by 2029. There is a widespread fear in Europe that if peace in Ukraine is negotiated on Russia's terms, then Russia may use the time to regroup and come back bigger and stronger than before. From Brussels, DW's security correspondent Terry Schultz reports on Europe's efforts to strengthen its defense forces.
The possible timeline within which Russia may try to strike Europe beyond Ukraine gets shorter all the time, with the German foreign minister's warning this could happen in less than 4 years, just the latest alarm. What's not changing fast is NATO's ability to move its tanks and troops to the front line as reinforcement after any such attack might happen. Bridges, roads, and tunnels are often simply impassable for heavy equipment. Bureaucracy and border procedures are bulky. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas says bluntly, this situation is not acceptable.
It is quite simple. The faster we can move forces, the stronger our deterrence and defense. We need to be talking about days, not weeks, to move troops in Europe. 11 years after Russia annexed Crimea, this is simply not good enough.
The European Commission has identified 500 bottlenecks, and that's just the top priorities, which it's trying to address urgently in its new military mobility upgrade plan. By the end of 2027, the Commission wants the 27 member states to eliminate as much as possible the obstacles to quick movement of military forces. Instead of the current situation, in which at least one country has retained the right to take a month and a half to respond to a request for passage across its borders, new regulations would require that answer to come in 3 days during peacetime. In case of conflict, it wouldn't even be necessary to ask permission, just to notify of the transit. Transportation Commissioner Apostolos Tsitsikostas, one of four top officials who were concurrently on stage presenting the new plan, said this does not mean Europe necessarily believes conflict is coming.
So in the question, is Europe preparing for war? The answer is no. Europe is preparing for peace. Europe wants peace. But if we want peace, we need first to be ready for war.
European defense could have been more ready much earlier had EU and national leaders acted on the numerous reports over decades identifying these problems as well as their solutions. Mihai Chiaia with the European Policy Center is among the researchers who have investigated and published repeatedly on the challenges and urgency of improving military mobility.
There is a bit of disconnect between the progress that has been done, of course, on paper, in policy documents, in strategies, which is good progress, but then in practice, we don't see that much.
Chiaia points out the infrastructure projects that need to be undertaken would require many years to finish, and most of them haven't even been started.
We have the strategies, we have the priorities to enhance military mobility, but then what is needed in the end is political will. And what we see, according to my opinion, is that the political will is not where it should be.
More than a decade ago, when U.S. Army General Ben Hodges was in charge of American forces in Europe, he was running into the same problems of red tape and restrictions as he was commanding multinational exercises with NATO forces. He recalls one memorable moment during an air jump exercise.
The Bulgarian Interior Ministry was going to require each paratrooper to show his passport after he landed because they had entered Bulgaria. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. How could this be? We've been working on this exercise for a year. Eventually it got sorted, but I mean, that was the kind of thing that we encountered.
Back then, Hodges coined the term a military Schengen zone to call for harmonized transport plans across alliance territory, something that's still lacking.
We need the same effect that a truckload of apples could go from Poland all the way to Lisbon, Portugal without ever stopping because they could travel all the way through the Schengen zone. And I said, that's what we need for NATO forces, for military forces, to be able to move without stopping.
Now the Commission is using the same term. Some countries have gone ahead and set up this kind of corridor. A group led by the Netherlands, Germany, and Poland has now been joined by five others, a model for the rest of the continent. While infrastructure upgrades will take many years, Mihai Chiaia says some improvements could be made immediately, like simply having conversations between ministries, armed forces, national and local authorities, and the private sector.
What we see is that these actors don't really cooperate together to enhance military mobility. In some cases, they don't even speak to each other.
The Commission's proposal for the EU's next seven-year budget, which is currently under negotiation, would allocate just over 17.5 billion euros to help member states start their upgrades. It's not a lot spread over 27 countries in 7 years, but it is 10 times more than the last budget contained. Ben Hodges will be watching closely to see how much is left when the budget is approved by both the European Council and the European Parliament.
If you're serious about something, you put money on it and you put people on it. If you don't put money on it or you don't put people on it, then you're not really serious.
He says Europe must be serious this time about ensuring its militaries can get to the front line, because Russia surely is serious about testing that itself. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
As European nations ready themselves for war, some countries neighboring Russia say they need landmines for their defense. That story is coming up later on our show. People in the United States are paying close attention to news of an immigration crackdown on Somali American communities in Minnesota. This is after President Trump's recent remarks calling Somalis names and saying they are not wanted in this country. People in Somalia are watching, too. On the street in Mogadishu, Ahmed Aka told the German broadcaster DW, quote, "This is a blatant offense to Somalis," adding, "I wonder why he focuses on us. This isn't the language expected from a president." Abdurrahman Moral said, "This is intolerable. Trump insults us daily, calling us garbage and other names." He went on to say that he was disappointed that his own government had not spoken out, even when pressed. He is referring to comments from Somalia's prime minister, Hamza Abdi Bari, who told a crowd, quote, "We are not the only country Trump insults. Sometimes it's better not to respond." Somali national Adan Bakr spoke to Al Jazeera and said he was insulted, but took his prime minister's words to heart. He says we are Somali citizens living in our own country. His decisions do not affect us directly because we have our own identity and sovereignty as Somalis. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Soccer is the world's most popular sport. It is also the most universal. People pretty much play it everywhere, and they will watch the FIFA Men's World Cup next summer when it's joint hosted by the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And today was a major step in the journey to kick off.
So, ladies and gentlemen, señoras y señores, mesdames et messieurs, welcome.
FIFA President Gianni Infantino welcomed the crowd in Washington, D.C. to the official draw of the World Cup, revealing which countries will play each other. The world's Bianca Hillier is here with the updates. Hello, Bianca.
Hi.
So I did catch a glimpse of this today. It looked like quite a spectacle.
It was a spectacle. There were celebrities and big-name athletes. The draw is usually held in the host nation. This year it was at the Kennedy Center in D.C. But all of the North American heads of state were there today, including Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, and U.S. President Donald Trump. And it took about 90 minutes of pomp and circumstance to get to the actual draw.
Okay, and so when they actually got there, what did it look like? How does the draw actually work?
It's refreshingly analog, this part of it. All of the teams were put into pots, mostly determined by their world ranking, and people on stage picked up little balls from glass bowls to select the actual matchups. The balls were like Easter eggs with pieces of paper in them that said the country's names. And so this draw process is considered more fair than something like March Madness, where a committee of humans have the final say on how the bracket looks.
Okay, it sounds a little bit more randomized than that. Mm-hmm. So does that randomized draw result in any big matchups, or did it this year? Are any big rivals facing off?
Oh, they sure are. The one that caught my eye is Brazil versus Morocco. Back in 2022, Morocco made history by becoming the first African nation to reach the semifinals. And Brazil, of course, is one of these world powerhouses in the sport. So that's going to be a battle. Spain versus Uruguay is also going to be tough. So is France and Norway. The reason we don't have any of the top-ranked teams matched up against each other, that's by design. For the first time, FIFA has kept the top-seeded teams on separate sides of the draw, so they can't meet until the final if they make it there. So the same rule will apply with France and England and Spain and Argentina.
Okay, I see. So those are the big teams. But this year, people are also getting excited about some of the smaller teams who have made it to the World Cup for the very first time. How did they fare today?
Yeah, you know, they have a tough job ahead of them. First-timers Uzbekistan will have to play Portugal and Colombia. Curaçao has got to get past Germany.
Oy.
Haiti is in the same group as Brazil and Morocco. And Cape Verde will have to take on number one ranked Spain in their very first game. One reason that so many of these countries have qualified for the first time is because the tournament has expanded. There are 48 teams competing next summer compared to 32 teams in previous years.
And there was also something else that was new this year, a new addition to the event, the FIFA Peace Prize given out for the very first time this year, right?
Yes, this was the inaugural edition. FIFA announced this new award a month ago, and they said it would honor someone who has taken exceptional actions toward peace. A lot of people immediately thought that this award was designed to be given to President Trump. And Carolyn, that is exactly what happened. It was presented to him today with a video. Here's part of it.
Under President Trump's leadership, the historic Abraham Accords were signed, bringing the first real progress in the Middle East in decades. His leadership has ensured that peace exists.
The FIFA video went on to name seven global conflicts they say Trump has ended. Many around the world would refute that, as we've reported on our show, saying that peace has not been reached in many of those regions. And just like the actual Nobel Peace Prize, FIFA's process for selecting this winner is not very transparent. You know, we don't know if there were nominations. We don't know who exactly picked the winner or what the, you know, real criteria was for picking the winner.
So there's no new information on what went on behind the scenes here. But as you said, people thought from the very beginning that Trump would get this award. Why is that?
Because Trump and FIFA President Gianni Infantino are very close, and Infantino needs to keep it that way to have the World Cup go smoothly. So the FIFA Peace Prize going to Donald Trump was not, or it was largely expected. Still, Sylvia Schenck, a former member of FIFA's Independent Human Rights Advisory Board, said it's still surprising to hear Trump getting credit for ending all of these wars when in reality there's still not peace on the ground.
I think it's something like a joke, but on the other side it's of course very, very serious. And what else should you expect from Infantino and Trump? It's theater.
Theater, she says. All right, before I let you go, real quick, do we know where these teams are playing yet?
We don't. You're going to have to wait until tomorrow for that. That's when FIFA is announcing where the games are taking place. And if your favorite player or a home country hasn't qualified yet, there still may be a chance because there's six spots up for grabs, and those qualifying games will be in March.
All right. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show. She's been filling us in on the official draw for next summer's World Cup. Bianca, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
T To counter the threat posed by Russia, European countries are increasingly willing to take measures once considered extreme. Several countries say they want to go back to using landmines on the battlefield, despite an international ban on the weapons negotiated 3 decades ago, a ban that the U.S. and Russia notably did not sign. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
In January 1997, Diana, Princess of Wales, made a trip to Angola. She was there for a cause.
It's an enormous privilege for me to be invited here to Angola in order to assist the Red Cross in its campaign to ban once and for all anti-personnel landmines.
At the time, Angola had the highest number of amputees per capita, Diana said. On that trip, she famously walked through a field that had been cleared of landmines.
There is a mine there. I'm not going to go inside there.
And she spoke with experts about the painstaking, the slow process of demining. The trip made global headlines, and by the end of that year, countries adopted a landmark treaty in Ottawa. The treaty banned the production, stockpiling, and transfer of anti-personnel landmines. Tamar Gabelnick says the mine ban treaty has been a huge success. About 166 countries have signed on to it.
All of those countries but two have destroyed all of their stockpiles of landmines. That's 55 million mines destroyed.
Gabelnick directs the international campaign to ban landmines, which was one of the major forces behind the treaty. But the success of the treaty is under threat. This year, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Finland, and Poland have said they want to withdraw. Ukraine says it wants to suspend its participation.
These are severe tests for this convention and for all of the work we're doing to protect civilians against indiscriminate weapons.
The European countries say they share borders with Russia, and it has been using landmines in the war against Ukraine. They argue deploying the weapons on land will help them fight off Russia's aggressions. Gabelnick says landmines have limited use in today's warfare.
If they have any marginal military utility, it's far outweighed by the humanitarian impact that these horrific weapons have.
Landmines are basically buried bombs. They're indiscriminate, she says, and they can't be aimed at an enemy. Data shows the overwhelming majority of those killed by mines are civilians.
Using landmines in this modern era will not give you any kind of advantage.
Zoran Jesic was a soldier in the Serbian army and lost his right leg when he stepped on a landmine in Bosnia. Speaking on a TRT program called Roundtable, Jesic says it took him a long time to recover from his injuries. And now to hear the discussion about deploying mines again, it's like a slap in the face of survivors like him, he says.
It brought me back in my reality in 1994. I started to go through that again in my dreams.
Despite the Ottawa Treaty, landmines continue to take lives and maim people, says Jerry Simpson of Human Rights Watch. Just in the past year, there's been over 2,000 documented casualties, he says, mainly in Syria and Myanmar.
This is an example of why landmines are such a scourge.
In one case, Simpson says, goats that belonged to a shepherd in Bosnia wandered into a minefield, which was marked.
But the shepherd needed his goat back because it was worth so much money, and so he took the risk and lost his life.
Children also make up a large portion of the casualties, he says. This week, signatories to the Ottawa Treaty met in Geneva to discuss progress. Simpson, who participated in the meetings, describes the departure of the 5 European countries as a catastrophic step backwards. He says the topic was a big elephant in the room.
So we and many others have been in contact with officials from these countries, and it doesn't really matter how rational or objective the arguments are. The response is, we're not interested.
Tamar Gabelnick of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines says the push for a return to landmine use in these countries comes more from a political standpoint than an effective military strategy. These leaders want to be seen as taking steps to counter Russia.
Their populations are afraid, terribly afraid of Russia, and I can certainly understand that. But what the governments aren't telling people is to be afraid of the use of landmines.
Princess Diana never got to see the long-term impact of her visit to Angola. She died in a car crash in August of that year. But her legacy lives on. Gable Nick says amid the bad news, there's a glimmer of hope.
There were actually two new parties, states parties this year. They're small Pacific islands, but it doesn't matter.
The Marshall Islands and Tanga in Papua New Guinea are the new members of the Ottawa Treaty. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This next story starts with a riddle. What is silent when alive but cries after death? Do you give up? The answer is a conch. Okay, here's why. The large sea snails that inhabit the shells do not make noise, but the shells themselves, once the snail is gone... Behold the cries of the conch shell. If someone blows into it, of course. The World's Jerry Haddon is about to bring us more shell sounds from Barcelona. Researchers there say they've found compelling evidence the shells were used for messaging and even music earlier than we imagined.
Imagine you're a sea snail and you die, and your house gets turned into a trumpet. Kind of a cool idea, and the sound's even cooler.
The shell trumpet is a conch shell modified in order to be converted in an instrument and produce sound.
This is 27-year-old Miquel López García speaking and playing. López has two jobs, digging stuff up as an archaeologist and blowing into things. Those dual skills landed the University of Barcelona doctoral candidate on a team researching Neolithic conch shells dating back 6,000 years here at a center called Art Soundscapes.
There are two possibilities, to have two different specialists in the team or to have a trumpet player and archaeologist in the same person. I'm a classic trumpet player and I also play the trombone and other brass instrument.
Art Soundscapes is a project of the European Research Council. It explores the crossroads of sound and archaeology.
The project is about sound in prehistory.
This is López's co-researcher, Margarita Díaz-Andreu. She says archaeology tends to focus on objects, say shards of pottery, but imagining what things sounded like brings another dimension to our understanding.
It is a way of breaking the silence with which we think about prehistory. It's a way of giving sound to the past.
In this case, by trying to recreate prehistoric sounds in the present. See, Diaz and López had a hunch that a handful of modified ancient conches locked away in Barcelona's museums were musical instruments.
All these pieces are preserved in museums since the 1980s, but these pieces have been kept silent for decades.
López says everyone just assumed they were classic conch horns, meant to send loud signals over long distances, because they'd been modified specifically for what seemed to be that purpose.
The main feature and the main transformation of these shell trumpets is the removing of the apex.
That's the pointy tip of the conch shell, opposite the large spiral opening.
The intentional removing of this part is what really indicates us that there's a possibility that this conch shell was used like a sound instrument.
To get that sound from the shell, you blow into the hole where the apex was. They're still used for sending messages on some Pacific islands. López says that's the conch sound that's been embedded in the public imagination, especially via films.
What's that?
It's a conch! If it had a hole in it right there, you could really blow it, like a trumpet.
This is from the 1990 version of William Golding's classic novel, Lord of the Flies, about English schoolboys marooned on a Pacific island. Indeed, the conch as signaling horn is well documented in many places and cultures around the world. But no one considered Barcelona's ancient conches as musical possibilities, because their range is limited, usually to two or three notes. But López believes otherwise, given the human modifications. With his trumpeting chops, he's managed to coax the unexpected out of the shells. ¶¶
We found that using a different variety of musical techniques, you can produce melodies using these instruments, simple melodies. But for me, it's clear that these shell trumpets could have had also an expressive and emotional function.
Expressive, emotional. At least one other musician has managed to show that range of the conch, at least in modern times. Renowned American jazz trombonist Steve Turay is also a seashell virtuoso. This is Turay double conchinet in London in 2007 with the Dizzy Gillespie United Nations Orchestra. Turay on the shells, clearly keeping pace with some of Latin jazz's top players of the time. Of course, Neolithic shell songs would have been quite different, more limited, less sophisticated, assuming conches were used in music back then. There's no hard proof, say Lopez and Diaz, but at least now they've proved it was possible. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
And now a quick stop in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, to smell the flowers, or at least to talk about them, because a rare floral phenomenon is unfolding there. Talipot palm trees are in bloom. They live up to 80 years long and bloom just once in their lives. In Rio's Flamengo Park and also its botanical gardens, millions of tiny off-white flowers are in bloom, in sprays shooting up high above the palm's fronds. They make the tree look like it's wearing an elaborate headdress, kind of like the performers wear at the Rio Carnival, actually. The trees are native to southern India and Sri Lanka. They were planted in Rio in the 1960s, and these once-in-a-lifetime blossoms mark the end of these trees' life cycles. The current blooms could become seedlings if they're fertilized, starting the cycle all over again. One country is hoping to get all of its electricity from solar power, Vatican City. A tiny country, but still. The Catholic Church's goal of 100% solar for the Vatican was put in place by the late Pope Francis. That was in 2015. Now a solar farm is in the works that would help the Vatican meet its goals. We are looking into this today for The Big Fix, our series hearing about the people and communities innovating to deal with climate change. Dan Misla is founder and executive director of the Catholic Climate Covenant. That's a Washington-based nonprofit pushing for climate equity and justice. He told us the Vatican got approval to build the solar farm earlier this year.
Pope Francis actually initiated this a few months before he died, and Pope Leo is following through.
The proposal here for these solar panels on a farm outside of Vatican City would be to combine solar panels with agriculture. How does that work? Can you tell us how solar panels and agriculture are combined on the same footprint?
Yeah, it's becoming a thing. The solar panels are raised above the ground a certain height, and then crops can be planted underneath and between the rows of panels. And the idea is that crops that can't take excessive heat or need to retain the ground, where the ground needs to retain more moisture, these panels actually provide a little bit of shade for those crops to be protected from the blazing sun and so forth. And so they tend to do much better actually with a little bit of shade rather than just, you know, in an open field.
And then it's not like solar panels are competing with agriculture for land. You can have both on the same footprint.
That's right. Yeah. And that's another big benefit, because in a lot of places they're, you know, tearing up farmland or taking down forests to put solar in. And if we can have the best of both worlds, why not do that?
Now, this plan for a solar farm is just one component of a larger vision to reduce Vatican City's carbon emissions. The Holy See released a plan earlier this year committing to a 28% reduction in emissions over the next decade. What else is in that plan?
Yeah, I understand that they've already done, they've replaced like 100,000, you know, lighting fixtures to LED. They're looking at their fleet of automobiles. Pope Francis also instituted a place at Castel Gandolfo called Borgo Laudato Si, which has become a place of not only beauty but also a farm, community-supported agriculture. So there's there's lots of things that they're trying to do to reduce their footprint. And this began under Pope Benedict XVI when he put solar panels on the roof of the Paul VI Center in the Vatican City itself.
Vatican City is small. It's only a little over 100 acres, and the Catholic Church owns nearly 180 million acres of land around the world. I understand that there's no central accounting of the emissions tied to those holdings. Is the Vatican taking steps to address carbon emissions outside of their tiny little Vatican City?
Well, certainly the last several popes, in fact, going back to Paul VI, they've talked about the need to be better caretakers of creation. So the Vatican is, and then leading up to Laudato Si and Pope Francis, and now Pope Leo is also carrying on that message. So certainly the Vatican is very concerned about the destruction of the environment, climate change, biodiversity, all of those types of things that we're concerned about. And so they're encouraging Catholic bishops and dioceses and other Catholic organizations to reduce their carbon footprint.
We've been talking about Laudato Si, a letter about caring for creation that Pope Francis wrote 10 years ago. Can you just define what that was and tell us a little bit more about it for those who might not know?
Yeah, so it was an encyclical letter, which is the highest level of teaching authority that a pope can institute. And it was the first time that an encyclical letter, there have been plenty of others, first time that it focuses just on the environment. And in that letter, Pope Francis challenged us to begin to think more clearly and more soberly about the predicament that we're in with the environment. And Pope Francis wrote this not just for Catholics, but for everyone to look at. And when this came out in 2015, it had a huge impact. In fact, it influenced the Paris Agreement, and environmental groups embraced it. Other people of faith embraced it. And he really struck a nerve to help people of faith and people of goodwill to move forward on recognizing the problem, dealing with the problem, acting on the problem.
So there are a lot of government figures, of organizations, of people who, set goals to reduce carbon emissions, and there has been less action on actually making that happen. Laudato Si, this encyclical on climate change from the Vatican, was over 10 years ago now. How effectively do you think that the Vatican has transformed that vision into actual action? Like, what are the milestones you can point to?
Sure. It's mixed, to be sure. Church is a big church. I think more is going on, particularly in we just heard this at COP30, that the bishops in the Global South, this is becoming a much bigger concern for them. So there's many more activities, projects, and programs that they're doing that are related to Laudato Si than the Global North. Europe is doing fairly well. The United States has a ways to go, but there are signs here through our work and others that the bishops in the United States are beginning to embrace this more and more as well. And part of it is people are being impacted by climate change, so they're finally waking up to say, "Oh, there is really something to this, and we need to be active and proactive in trying to reduce emissions and live more in keeping with a finite planet."
Pope Leo XIV became pope about 8 months ago. What do we know so far about what action he might take on climate change to further transform this vision into actual action?
Well, I had the privilege of meeting Pope Leo on October 1st at a conference at Castel Gandolfo, south of Rome, and he gave an amazing speech, basically reiterating Francis's teaching and legacy and encouraging everyone to act. He said, "Look, we're sort of finished with data. We got the data. We know what we need to do. We just need to go out there and do it." So he's very much carrying on the legacy of Pope Francis, in my view.
And we will wait and see if Vatican City does become 100% solar powered under his tenure.
That's right.
Dan Misla is the executive director and founder of the Catholic Climate Covenant. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. You can also find our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH, all one word. Please check us out and subscribe. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Have a fabulous weekend, and we will see you back here, same time, same place, on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.